Hey, everybody. We got a great conversation for you on this episode of the Michael Steele podcast, because by now it's clear that the red wave that GOP promised, it never came. And it never came to the midterms, in large part because of Gen Z voters turning out in historic numbers. So I'm going to be joined today by two Gen Z political activists who've worked tirelessly to make this reality come true. Victor Shi is a former White House intern, host of the On the Move with Victor Shi, co-host of iGen Politics, and strategy director of Voters Tomorrow. And Mariana Pecora is a deputy director of communications for digital engagement at Voters of Tomorrow, a Gen Z-led movement that engages, educates, and represents youth in American politics. So sit back and learn on this one, folks, particularly all of you baby boomer types and everybody else who ain't Gen Z. I think you'll get a really good insight into what motivates, what moves, and what is shaping their politics, the Gen Z politics of today. We'll have that and a whole lot more coming up next on the Michael Steele podcast. Well, welcome everybody to the Michael Steele podcast. As I noted in the intro, I'm all about this conversation, and I've been about it for a very, very long time, looking at the impact that young voters have on the outcome of elections and the course and the direction of the country. And I got to know this young brother, Victor, over the past year through his writings that you may see in national publications, and the work that he's doing, all this from a former White House intern. he's not just an intern anymore. But Victor, I wanted to welcome you, and certainly Mariana, is the first time we get to chat, so welcome to you as well, from the campus of the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. So let's just jump into this conversation in a way that sort of sets the table for those who are listening and may or may not appreciate the impact that voters have had, young voters have had, in the most recent election in 2022. But even going back a little bit to 2018, and Victor, you've written about this almost like a, you know, moonstruck moment where you're trying to slap the country upside the head to make them recognize just how powerful a vote this is. Before we get into the issues that are animating those voters, what do you make of the impact that they're having? Start with you, Victor.
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having us. It's great to see you again. And I know we met each other for the first time in person in DC, and this is great to see you through a screen this time. But I would say you asked that question, I think, wonderfully, in the sense that a lot of people forget that for Gen Zers and young people, 2018 was the time where we really saw young people turn out to vote in historic numbers. That was the first time that you saw young people turn out to vote in droves. About 30% of us went out there and voted, which was a historic number. And you saw that sustained throughout 2020. A historic number of Gen Zers turn out to vote. That's what really got Joe Biden elected in 2020, and then Reverend Warnock and John Ossoff elected in their runoff race in 2021. And then you saw that momentum continue to sustain throughout 2021, throughout 2022. And then, of course, you had that leaked Dobbs decision that I think really motivated a lot of young people to go out there and register to vote and make their voices heard. But like you said, it really started in 2018, and there's this just kind of continuation of momentum building from young people ever since.
How about you, Mariana? What's your take on this landscape?
I think that it says a lot about what our generation as a whole is believing. If you really think about it, 2018 was the very first time that members of Gen Z were eligible to vote. And not only did young people show up in big numbers in 2018, but as more young people became eligible to vote in 2020, we showed up in even larger numbers for the presidential election. And then even though it looks like that number is going to be a little bit smaller in 2022, we're still seeing insanely high youth voter turnout in this year. So it's showing that this is a pattern that is specific to Gen Z. This is something that our generation cares a lot about. We're engaged, we're involved, we're looking at our country, and we're saying we want to make our voices heard. And I also think that it's really important to recognize that young people are doing this after years and years of seeing bad examples at the top of our government. Like, it is sort of animated by the Trump administration and Donald Trump's presidency. I know that for me, I was in sixth grade when he was elected president. And the very first time that I was paying attention to politics as a young person, as someone that was trying to learn more about our world, I was seeing an example of a leader that wasn't what I thought leadership should look like in our country. It didn't represent my American values. It didn't represent the values that I thought that other people that I knew and loved had. And we were ready to sort of make our voices heard and show that this is not what we want to see in our leadership.
So we'll just let slide the fact that you were in sixth grade when Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. We'll let that one go.
That was the primary. I was in seventh grade when he was actually.
Oh, okay. I feel so much younger now. Thank you. Oh my God. But that's the beauty of this. That's the beauty of what I love about your generation, is that you are dialed in from an early age. Unlike, with all respect to my kids who are in their 30s, and the generations between them and you, they weren't dialed in. I love to talk about what happened after the Stoneman Douglas shootings, and how those young students then in high school said, "Damn it, we're done with this." And it really became emblematic and a real personification of what you're both describing around the young people's involvement, the level of involvement, the level of commitment, and the follow through with the action of voting, which has always been for a lot of people one of the big sort of slaps at young voters is, yeah, but they don't vote. Yeah, they get all upset and pissed off, and they like to march and scream and yell, but they don't vote. And as everybody knows, the way you change the system is by voting. You don't change the system by screaming. And you've got to get someone that actually is going to cast a vote on a legislative initiative or on some type of executive order in order to begin to move that needle. And the way you do that really boils down to who you put in office. When you look at what young people did in the 2018 cycle, sending to Congress a new generation of young sort of center-left Democrats, mainly, mostly women, to Congress, it set a tone. Then you look at this cycle where Gen Zers have elected one of their own to go to Congress. That tells you how much you stayed engaged in this, right? Either one of you.
Yeah, and going back to the idea that sort of Stoneman Douglas really did set a lot of this off, because I do think that that's true. I really do think there are two main things that are pushing young voters to continue to stay engaged, to not let any sort of disillusionment or animosity towards the political system get them down. And I really do think it is fear and it is hope. Firstly, fear. We are every single day dealing with the consequences of decisions that generations before us have made, whether that be not having gun violence prevention that keeps.
Is that a polite way of saying how much we screwed it up? Because I say it. So you are perfectly fine on this podcast to say, yo, still, y'all messed this ish up, because we did.
I mean, yeah, and we're going to have to deal with that for a really long time. And you guys aren't going to have to deal with it for as long as we are.
Right.
So we're going to be dealing with the consequences of decisions that legislatures and our parents and grandparents and every voter before us made. And that's challenging, right? We're seeing there's limited action on climate change. We've had good investments in the past couple of years, but there's so much more that we could be doing. Just sort of the things that really do determine our future have been decided by people older than us. And that's scary for young people. It drives us to the polls with fear because we want to protect our future. Going off of that, I think there is a hope amongst young people that we can build the future that we want to see. And so we are electing young progressive people like Maxwell Frost that really do represent the ideologies of our generation and are going to fight for and protect the rights and the legislation that young people want to see.
So if I can
go ahead.
If I can clear, I do think Mariana hit it right on the head when she said, I mean, it is so much about fear. There's so much anger. There's so much outrage. And that's really what I think drives a lot of young people to the polls. And we were talking about Trump earlier, and I can't overstate, I think, how big of a factor I think Trump was in motivating young people to register to vote and show up, because that was, if you think about it, really the first time that a lot of young people started paying attention. 2016 represented a time, I think, when young people were very idealistic about the prospects of the first woman becoming president, Hillary Clinton being the first woman to really clinch the nomination and become president. But Donald Trump became president, and it wasn't a 4 years that was necessarily smooth, as you know, Michael. I mean, it was so turbulent. You saw this president constantly break norms and traditions. And I think that's why in 2018, you saw young people show up for the first time ever in historic numbers and really just say, you know, this is something that we're going to reject. We're not going to stand for this Trump administration that is constantly chastising immigrants and demonizing racial minorities. We want a Congress that actually stands up for us and our rights. And so I think that's why you saw so many young people start to get involved. And then since 2018, you would think that Republicans would learn something, but it's this continuation of this extremism and cult of personality around Trump. And I think young people really aren't oblivious to that. We see what's going on, and then we see this continuation of attacks on our lives. And that's, I think, what drives a lot of that anger and frustration that ultimately led to 2020 and then a couple weeks ago with 2022.
So what happens when Trump goes away? Trump's no longer there. Trump is a fading factor among some, at least, in the Republican Party. Still a major player, not discounting that. But the reality of it is, whatever Trump is and whatever infection he brought into the party is now bigger than him. So it's he's not necessary to the narration of the story. You've got others who are lining up, falling all over themselves, in fact, to replace him, starting with Governor DeSantis of Florida. Where does a Nikki Haley or even a Mike Pence, the former vice president, land on this spectrum? So how do Gen Zers who are cognizant of what Trump and Trumpism represented the last 6 years, how are they looking at what the landscape politically and certainly with respect to democracy looks like over the next 6 years? Because the one thing about civic responsibility is it requires constant engagement. Now, some may argue that an 18-year-old will be 24-year-old in 6 years, a 24-year-old will be 30-year-old in 6 years. And so their level of engagement will mature, and they'll become a little bit more involved. I don't know if that's the way it plays out, but I want to see them at 19 and 20, as opposed to 29 and 30, also staying committed to what is an important fight for democracy. How are you guys at Voters of Tomorrow working to create that kind of landscape and level of engagement ongoing beyond just this cycle or the last cycle?
Well, I think that there's something really important. You mentioned Ron DeSantis. I'm going to throw Greg Abbott in the mix too, and a number of state legislatures and governors across the country that have been attacking education specifically in the last couple of years. And I think that that's really important to consider, because young voters aren't dumb. We're paying attention to this, and we know that there's a far right push to limit what we're able to learn in school, and we know that that has an effect on what our engagement, what our like intelligence level when it comes to civics and politics is, and what our sort of ability to interact with all this is going forward. And young people are not dumb. We're aware of it, and we're fighting back against it. And I do think that that has immeasurable impacts. And we at Voters of Tomorrow have been doing a lot of work on the protecting education front. But I also do think that young people, a lot of young people cite not knowing enough about politics as a reason to not vote, but like in personal experience and in data as well. But I think that if young people are curious, which they do seem to be, they're engaged, they mm-hmm. want to participate more in the political process, then we would like to be the place where they can come to us and find that information that they need and be able to get engaged and be able to feel comfortable casting a ballot. Because we are seeing these attacks on young people nationwide, and we're not going to be able to participate and be fully engaged if our governors are attacking our right to learn in school.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So as the director of strategy for Voters Tomorrow, what's your strategy there to capitalize on what Mariana just said? You know, that is the next important element of this. So what does that look like, and how do you reinforce it so that you now find yourself, Victor, every cycle trying to scare young people into voting or reminding them how bad it is? They just live through whatever the cycle is, so they know. I mean, people rationalize, inflation is high, and money's tight, and gas prices are high, but damn it, democracy does matter. Yeah. And so I'm willing to travel 2 miles less or not, you know, get the chicken cordon bleu in order to, stand for the principles that I think are more important than the price of a gallon of gas. That's a hard argument to make and sustain when people are feeling it. And young people, some would argue, are a little bit more cushioned because they've got relatives, parents, you know, if they're in college, university. But we also know a lot of young people who are caring for their families. They're the principal breadwinners for their families. And so there are those dynamics that, you know, will also allow them to check out. How do you strategize what Mariana described?
Absolutely. So first, if I can just share a brief anecdote, as Mariana was talking about the attacks on education, I was actually having this conversation with my roommate yesterday about critical race theory and how that was the first time that he's ever heard of something like critical race theory, because this isn't taught in elementary school. This isn't taught in middle school or right. high school. This is taught in law school. And you would know this, Michael, because you went to law school. And, you know, when young people hear this, it's like Republicans think that we fall for this. But when we hear this, it's like we've never been taught this before. So I think one end of kind of where Republicans, they've capitalized on the CRT talk. But young people are like, we have never heard of this before. In terms of how you, I think, strategize and get young people, I think, to sustain that momentum, start earlier, I think a lot of it has to do with, one, providing the resources to young people. Like Mariana said, I think a lot of young people feel like politics is a big, scary thing. A lot of it is about federal talk, what's happening on the national scale. But if you can get young people to think about what's happening on the local scale, what's happening in their community, what's happening in their school board elections, then it becomes much easier to, I think, imagine what that kind of change looks like. And I think a lot of it starts in high school and getting young people to become more civically aware. And part of the, you know, process is, one, groups like Voters of Tomorrow offering resources and ways to get involved and, you know, phone banking, text banking. But a lot of it, I think, is institutional. So having high schoolers, high school teachers set up things like voter registration drives, or making sure that young voters can cast their ballots and providing them with the information that they need. You know, I remember back in high school, I had this one teacher that coined, I think, a term that kind of captures it perfectly, which is the civics lifestyle. And I think a lot of the times we think of elections every 2 or 4 years, whereas it should be a continual thing for young people that they can get in that mindset earlier, thinking that, you know, every day, this is what politics is about. This is how it's impacting my life, whether it's, you know, the pothole in my area, or whether it's, you know, paying taxes. All of these things are somehow civically connected. And I think the younger we can get people to realize that, the better it can be and the more sustained that'll be. And so I think at the end of the day, it's resources, making sure that colleges and high schools provide as many opportunities for young people to vote and register to vote as possible.
Yeah, I have to shout that point to the rooftops, because the back end strategy is our political system has been redesigned, which is why our founders and folks who listen to this podcast have heard me say this a number of times, why our founders were so hesitant and concerned about political factions, parties being formed, because they thought that they would be mechanisms of abuse of power. They thought that they would misdirect the voters. And in large measure, that's kind of how it's played out. In fact, to your point, Victor, there is less interest in having you civically engaged or civically enlightened, which is why we don't teach civics anymore. Just think about what the politicians have done. They've allowed the deconstruction of civic lessons in our classrooms, in our nation's classrooms. Why? Because that's how you learn how the government worked. That's how you learned the power that was given to you by the Constitution and those infamous words, "We the people," and the power of those words. So when the politicians say, "Well, y'all don't need to learn civics," or paint and construct a paradigm in which elections are either A, something you only do every 2 years, right? Or B, when you do them, oh, it's such a burden. It's so hard. So you know what? I think I'm just going to pass on this one. You know, that's what the whole effort behind states like Florida and Georgia and elsewhere that have affirmatively taken steps to make it harder for people to get to the ballot box, creating long lines deliberately, taking out good machines and allowing bad machines to stay in place to frustrate the purpose. The challenge for Gen Zers is to not succumb to that ploy, to that trick, which has worked on every generation, starting with the baby boomers, since the baby boomers were the ones who really kind of perfected it. And so now it becomes a matter of how you engage ongoing, right? Around big and small issues. As you both noted, a lot of this is local level stuff that's driven at the ballot box, that's driven in local communities. Let's open up that box a little bit and talk about what are those issues that animate Gen Z voters, and how are your teams at Voters of Tomorrow addressing those issues and making them relevant up and down, state, local, federal? And I'll start with you. And I'll start with you, Mariana, because you're the comms director. Well, so the first part of this is, and you know, getting that message out on the street. We'll get to what you know guys like Victor do when they're thinking of the strategy, but it really does. You're on the kind of the front line of communicating internally what's happening on the street, so that you can then project back out what the opportunities are.
So in terms of what we're doing, I think the work that we're doing in our chapter program is sort of the ground level personal relational organizing that really is engaging young voters in sort of a national way. So we have chapters right now in 20 states. Within those state chapters, we have campus chapters where people are organizing in colleges and high schools, doing the work of registering voters, doing that education work that we were talking about, and then doing the work of getting people involved to volunteer for campaigns or to volunteer to elect candidates that are representing Gen Z and supporting the beliefs that we have as a generation. So that program, I think, is so incredibly important. And I also think the work that we're going to be doing on it in the coming months is incredibly important, because we're setting up an infrastructure that not only helped us in 2022, but we're building out and really diving deep into making sure that those chapter programs are strong on the ground networks that we continue to build out and expand right now, so that in 2024, we don't have to do that work, and we can just have a group of people across the country on the ground that are ready to mobilize and have those conversations with young voters. I also think that with young voters particularly, there's the challenge of not wanting to have older people talk down to them. They really don't want to hear this message from a parent or a parental figure or someone on TV screaming at them saying, "You don't vote, you should vote." Young people respond to their friends. They want to talk to each other. They want the conversations that they're having around politics to not be sort of, reprimanding. They want to be having a conversation about what they care about and why they should be spending their time voting. With that being said, the voting that we saw on college campuses this year was like insane. My friend at the University of Michigan waited like 6 hours in line to vote. We had friends in college campuses across the country. Victor was getting videos from friends at UCLA where the line was like half a mile long. Mm-hmm. And there's like in Georgia, we saw incredibly long lines in the runoff early voting period that were largely students. At Texas A&M, we saw incredibly long lines at the one polling place on election day on campus. And that was after we had led an effort to bus people to early voting sites because they took away the early voting site on campus. So we are seeing young people having these conversations around voting and doing the actual work of voting on their campuses, in colleges, in the places where they're spending the most time. And so that's where we're putting our time and resources, because that's where young people are. And we think that the best way to engage young voters is to meet them where they're at.
So I think Marianne hit on a really important bucket there, which is those individual conversations that happen on the ground in communities. I'll touch on maybe the kind of broader Democrat President Biden strategy that I think they're starting to invest more in. And that's just kind of like you said, Michael, how do you engage young voters after this election? Because time and time again, you saw this starting in 2018 through 2022, young people showed up. Now, how do you actually sustain them for future elections? And I think for Democrats and President Biden, they've already started to do this. And that's really, I think, harnessing young voters as the message for a lot of their successes. Like Mariana said, the people that young people listen most to are other young people. And so that's why I think before the election, you had President Biden bring in a large group of activists and influencers who are young, mm-hmm. who had a big platform on TikTok and who could really amplify that message. And young people paid closer attention to, I think, people like, you know, like Nia Su, who's a big, you know, young activist, rather than someone like President Biden or a Democrat on TV talking to them. So I think there's kind of that component of President Biden and Democrats really leveraging those non-traditional social media platforms and activists and young influencers. And then I think on the other hand, you also have this level of, okay, now we showed up. How can we create the infrastructure within the administration, within Congress, to make sure that young people actually have representation, the issues that we care about matter? And so part of it is having people like Maxwell Frost and working with Gen Zers in Congress and across the country to make sure that they actually kind of enact the issues that we care most about. But it's also setting up things like, for example, in the administration, there's this larger push to establish some sort of advisory council that would advise the president on all things regarding young people. And so as long as we can get those things, I think, kind of ingrained within institutions and make sure that Democrats and President Biden, now that we've showed up, actually engage us in the conversation, I think that's how you begin to sustain that conversation nationally and in our engagement.
We are having an engaging conversation, I knew it would be, with Victor Shi and Mariana Pecora from Voters of Tomorrow. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to do a little politicking on some politics. We'll be back with more right after this.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Michael Steele Podcast. We're engaged in I think, a very helpful and insightful conversation around the emerging strength and growth of Gen Z voters who are really reshaping the political landscape, particularly with the election of someone like a Maxwell Frost, the level of voter or sustaining a high level of voter turnout among Gen Z voters, younger voters, with our guests, Mariana Pecora and Victor Shi from the Voters of Tomorrow. So let's do a little politics unpacking here and kind of get into the makeup of the Gen Z voter I've been reading a number of things that paints a very interesting picture of a Gen Z voter. They tend to be a little bit more center-right than one would really think of young voters as, like, these flaming liberals. But it's not in the traditional sense. I mean, it may be around some economic issues. It may be around some other issues around, free speech or whatever. How would you describe your Gen Z voters that you're working with and running into on college campuses across the country? Because I would almost say that there is this, you know, there's a lot of place, certainly in conservative circles, where they like to throw up the UCLAs and the Harvards, where, you know, a conservative speaker is shouted down and they want to take that and launch into this sort of right wing screed that, you know, see these young people are not welcoming of conservative thought. Some of the Gen Zers I've talked to, I could see them in the Republican Party just as well as I could see them in the Democratic Party, and certainly as independent voters. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but give us a sense and flavor of who a typical Gen Z voter is.
So I'll just start by saying, I think that what you're seeing, and this is really interesting, especially from young people, is that we tend to reject party labels more than any other generation. So we find less young people actually say that they're a Democrat or Republican outright. And I think it's more about the values for a lot of young people. So what we actually believe in, what we want to see in our candidates. And on the most part, I think a lot of young people tend to agree with what the outcome should be. Maybe the process is different, but on a lot of the outcomes, these are things that impact all young people in this generation. Things like climate change, things like gun violence. These are things that young people have to grow up with. And whether you're Republican or you're Democrat, I think you find more overlap on a lot of those issues. And so at the end of the day, it's, you know, which party is going to actually support these issues? And I think right now it's becoming harder for young people to actually support this Republican Party that, one, I think has spent a long time just attacking young people on our rights.
Right.
And two, just really hasn't delivered. You think of, you know, what happened after the 2022 election. It's like every single time you would think that the Republican Party would take a step back, do some sort of autopsy report, which I know is you're no stranger to, Michael, but they don't. I mean, the thing that they have now is they want to raise the voting age. And they also say that young people are dumb for voting for Democrats. And when you attack young people, that's just not a winning strategy. And so I think a lot of the times, you know, we don't really strongly believe in one party or another. But right now, I think the reason why you see a lot of young people actually voting for Democrats is because you have such a contrast between both parties.
Yeah, just so I can clarify for the record, my point was not to say that those individuals who would be Republicans, my point was that they tend to have a more Republican view on some issues. In some of my conversations with them, and that's been very enlightening to me in terms of the broadness of scope and range on the issues. And you really articulated well. It's not so much about the party. It's not very little about the party, but it is about the philosophy and the ideology and all the other things that go into making up how I come to approach a particular issue, whether I think taxes should be higher or lower, whether corporations have a role or a civic social responsibility or they don't, you know. So there's a lot more thinking and an evolution in that thought than I think we've seen in past generations.
I want to build on what Victor said a little bit, because I do think it is incredibly true that young voters are very issue-driven voters and not necessarily party-driven voters. We do see sort of like the more social issues that Victor was talking about, like gun violence prevention, climate change, LGBTQ+ rights. But there is also sort of this narrative that young voters are sort of strictly socially driven. And I think that that's a really big mistake to make, because young voters are also economically driven, incredibly, because a lot of times young voters are the ones that are having trouble affording housing, having trouble affording their food. They're working entry-level jobs, minimum wage jobs, and they're just doing their best, like a lot of Americans are, to pay their bills and make it through the month. And so I think that you also take a look at which party has been doing the work to sort of prove themselves to those voters, to provide the resources that people in our country need. And it's not the Republican Party. The Republican Party, like Victor was saying, is doing things like trying to raise the voting age, take power away from young people, focusing on sort of like hyper-social issues like critical race theory and sort of Don't Say Gay and all of the very sort of anti-youth education war aspects of it. And then also just denigrating young people and saying that we're making bad decisions. And that's not going to be a way to bring people in. If the Republican Party wants to bring young people in, then show young people a tax proposal that's going to be beneficial to them.
Right.
So that's not happening. And young people aren't dumb about it. They see that.
They see it for what it is.
They know who's gonna fight for them. And right now it's not the Republican Party.
So do you see among Gen Zers a difference between an African American Gen Z voter and a Hispanic Gen Z voter, a female Gen Z voter? In other words, prior generations, again, we're notorious for it in my generation. I'm at the tail end, the very tail end of the baby boomers. And everything is compartmentalized and boxed and labeled, right? So, because it makes us feel so much better. You know, we just put it in the box and put it on the shelf and not have to deal with it. What do you see going on among Gen Z voters or non-voters, just Gen Z individuals, and how they look at the community of Americans, the community of people? In the context, especially of democracy, is there any of that compartmentalization? Is there sort of an appreciation for the historic relevance of let's say the Black narrative, the female narrative in this country? How does that play itself out and manifest itself?
So. I'll just say, I think it's becoming really hard to paint Generation Z in broad strokes. I mean, you have, you know, maybe a lot of kind of attempts to, but I think at the end of the day, what makes this generation so unique is that this is the most diverse generation in America. We are the most educated generation in America. And that's part of the reason why, at the end of the day, for both parties, the most important thing they can do is simply listen to as many Gen Zers as possible. Because every Gen Zer you're going to find, whether they're in California or New York or in the middle of the country, they're going to have some slightly different viewpoints. And if you're Black Gen Zer, if you're an Asian American Gen Zer, if you're a Hispanic Gen Zer, I think a lot of it really depends on kind of what, like where you are, like looking at them and kind of where they're from, because we're just kind of, there's so many of us and there's so many kind of different parts of Gen Zer, so many identities. This is the first generation that kind of dubs itself as the pluralistic we, in the sense that we have so many different communities and so many different identities and experiences that it's really hard, I think, for politicians and elected officials. And I think they would be kind of underserved if they think that they can just, you know, generally characterize Gen Zers. So that's why you have a lot of groups like Voters of Tomorrow and other organizations just really pushing for, one, the administration, and two, just anyone who's running for office, the best thing they can do is just sit down, talk to Gen Zers, and understand their concerns.
I don't think there's anything else to say. Victor hit it right on the head. We are an incredibly diverse generation, and I think that a lot of the mistakes that have been made in trying to sort of engage specific subsections of our population in the past have been that people have been painted as a monolith. The Hispanic community has been painted as a monolith for a really long time. Black voters are typically painted as a monolith, and I think that we can recognize with Gen Z that that is not true, and we should be taking that into our other conversations about other types of voters. But I don't think that you can ever paint an entire generation under broad strokes. It's going to be impossible to have like one specific Gen Z strategy in that works in one state and works in every other state. That's not going to work. The national Gen Z conversation needs to be different than the Gen Z conversation happening in a state, on a campus, in a classroom. And I think that we have to recognize that we are not a monolith. We are a group of individuals and a group of communities, right? And we're all going to think a little differently.
So in that thinking a little differently, is the goal then to reach a consensus around governing? How do you do that? And this is one of the interesting things that I'll be watching with Maxwell Frost, the newly elected member to Congress, how he reconciles an established order of things for good, bad, or indifferent, right? Not casting a judgment on the congressional structure, although I have a lot of judgments I could cast, against the sort of free flowingness of what you just described. I mean, are there things principally that Gen Zers as a consensus agree on? There may be no answer to that, and there's certainly no right or wrong answer. I'm just more curious as to how you see this generation evolving to marry up with a structure that requires structure, when that may or may not necessarily be the tool that your generation sees as a way to success. Conformity and all of those things, there may be some wisdom in saying, well, you know, Mariana in Washington, D.C., and Michael in Maryland, and Victor in California, having different experiences, when they meet up in Congress, can build a better consensus around sort of a preordained agreement around something that doesn't take into account all these other variables that clearly your generation is more sensitive about. That make any sense, or did I just lose you?
No, I think I've got you. And I think that there is something really important to recognize, which is that young voters are pragmatic. We know that not everything that we want to see is going to get done in an instant, but we do recognize that the structures that we have are the structures we have to go through.
Can I interrupt you there real quick, Mary? Yeah. Could you just put your finger on the thing that's so, and I'm so glad you answered that question that way, because that was the answer I was looking for. And you just affirmed for me why I feel and have felt the way I felt about David Hogg and those young people in Florida from Stoneman Douglas, because that's exactly what they were. They were pragmatic.
Yeah.
They actually used the system that was given to them, and they had an impact. They made an impact. They changed the laws in Florida. They did a little old school sit in legislators' offices because, okay, you got to come to work at some point. I'm going to be here. But they also did the new thing where they connected the networks of student bodies around the country and had a very pragmatic conversation about what reform could be achieved. So thank you for confirming that for me, because I didn't want to give the answer that I thought, but you just did, and I appreciate that. But I'll let you continue. I just wanted, because I'm old and I would have forgotten to make that point. So I just wanted to say.
Right. But it's just like, the structures that we have are the structures that we're going to have to go through to see the change that we want to make. It might take time. It might take a couple extra cycles of electing some more young people into office. But if the start of getting the things that we want to get done is putting Maxwell Frost into Congress, taking him from on the ground organizing, a little bit more sort of young, fun stuff, like working at March for Our Lives in the ACLU, and doing that organizing work then and there, and taking that and moving it to the place where all our decisions get made in this country, and putting one of those young people that has those conversations into that system, then I think that that's just the first step to taking our ideals and moving them into legislation.
So I want to go back. Your response just now triggered a thought in my head. I want to go back to the point I was making a little bit earlier, and I'm not trying to beat a horse here at all, but I just I'm just curious, and because I understand that Gen Zers do not look at politics through the lens of the political parties. Totally get that. But what do you do? Have you encountered through Voters of Tomorrow conservative Gen Zers, and how are discussions around the issues important? Again, irrespective, I'm not dealing on the tip of the scale with the Trump crazy, right? Because I know there's some folks who dance in that network, and that's fine. But I'm thinking about an 18-year-old Michael Steele growing up in Washington, D.C., and, you know, as a Black Republican in a Democratic household, surrounded by Democrats and trying to figure out where my voice is, Where does that young person fit in this conversation? I'm sure they do. The question is where and how are they are, because a lot of times, you know, people say, again, painting with broad brushes, you know, all young people are conservative until they get old, are liberals until they get older and they become conservatives. Well, that's not necessarily played out in real life, but there is some stereotypes that go along with that thinking about young people. And I'm just curious, what's been your conversations, or what have you heard in conversations around issues like the environment, where a young conservative Gen Zer may have a different perspective on how we approach climate change? And I'm thinking of a couple of young conservatives now who are working in that space, and how they are trying to reconcile, you know, with a broader narrative on climate as young conservatives, because they're, you know, young, their counterparts think that they don't care, but they do, and they actually have some plans. So I'm just curious as to how that plays itself out, or is playing itself out.
I mean, I think you have a ton of different kind of diverse perspectives within Generation Z. Just like you said, you have Republicans, you have Democrats. And I think if there is one way to kind of capture at the end of the day what Gen Zers care about, whether you're a conservative or a Democrat, that I've kind of seen within my conversations, is that we just want to see our lives get better. And I think that's what really, I think, unites this generation. It's that when you talk to Democrats, when you talk to young Republicans, what they both agree on is the sense that our lives are really kind of messed up in this world. There's this huge political polarization and kind of effort to get us apathetic and to get us exhausted. And so at the end of the day, we agree, one, the importance of the issues, whether it's climate change or gun violence, to get better. The outcome, I think, is the same no matter what generation or how old the person is within Generation Z. And the second, I think, is no matter who you talk to, there is this really big push to get more representation of Gen Zers in Congress, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. At the end of the day, we just want to see more of us in this system, because I think anyone who is a part of this generation knows that the way that politics is traditionally done, where you have older white guys in office or older people making the decisions, just isn't a sustainable model. And so that's why you see a lot of Republicans across the country running for office, also a lot of Democrat Gen Zers running for office, because at the end of the day, we want to see more of Gen Zers get involved and run for office and win, because that's, I think, how a lot of us know that that's how change starts. But that's kind of the common ground where I see most of that happening is kind of the fact that we just want to see our lives get better, and we want to see more of us be represented in government and the spaces that we see, whether it's media or institutions.
Mariana, in your space, how have, how can I put it? I guess social media and influencers played a role in Gen Z's surging in our politics and the role that they're playing ongoing?
I think that there's a really challenging conversation that we need to have about social media and how we're using it for politics specifically right now, because I think one of the really big things that we're seeing is that social media can be a great way to get information in front of someone's face. It's not always the best way to engage them, though. Like, where's the step between, where's the step between giving a young voter information and making sure that young voter is turning out to vote, or giving a young voter information and making sure that that information turns into them signing up for a phone bank or a text bank? I think that there's a lot of really interesting ways that social media is being used right now. I also think that there's a really difficult conversation we need to have about the algorithms that we're using on social media and that we're relying on a lot, because something like TikTok, great, you can get a million views on a TikTok about a politician that's running for office. We have to question, though, is that algorithm serving the video to people that may not have seen information about that candidate before? Or are those a million people that already knew about that candidate, were already going to turn out and vote, were already going to do what you wanted them to do with that video anyways? So,
or just how much the Chinese are looking in at the video. But that's another conversation.
But like, it is really difficult, and it's something that we're having a lot of really tough conversations about. We're trying to think about how we can rely less on the algorithm and do more of that direct voter outreach, making sure that our content that we're producing is reaching young people and is finding a way to engage them. And I think that that has a lot to do with the platforms that we're using. In my work for Voters of Tomorrow, I do a lot of the digital communications. And I know that I've found that I like Instagram better for trying to engage young voters than I like TikTok, because TikTok isn't a platform that's necessarily suited to conversation. It's suited to seeing something and scrolling past it. Whereas Instagram, you have a little bit more of an opportunity to connect with people. Right. And I've found that that's a better way to have a conversation with young people. It's a better way to get them more likely to sign up for a shift, to sign up to join Voters of Tomorrow, or even just to get them to read the second slide in a post. So I do think it is a conversation about how we're presenting information and how we're sort of taking the next steps to make sure that it's not just presenting information, but then engaging people after that.
So, Victor, during the Georgia runoff, and I'm curious if you're doing it for this one as well, Voters of Tomorrow announced a partnership with Uber to get voters to the poll, to get young voters to the poll. How are you engaging in other partnerships like that in this special election cycle, elections coming up? What role do you see your organization playing in this sort of turnout modeling for future elections?
Yeah, so in terms of Georgia, just one slight correction. We're actually partnering with this organization called Plus One Votes, but the entire effort is funding Uber drives to and from the gotcha. Polling location for young people. So if they're a college student, we know that notoriously it's hard for college students to find time out of their day to go to the ballot box. And a lot of the places in Georgia, when we talk about voter suppression, a lot of the colleges simply don't have polling locations. So the nearest one might be 10, 15 minutes away. And that's a hard lift, I think, for a lot of young people to get to. And so part of this effort right. is making sure that young people have access to the ballot box. And that's one effort that we're doing in Georgia. I think some other efforts that you can kind of expect from us going forward is just these continued organizational kind of partnerships to make sure that young people have access to resources, to the ballot box, to make sure they can make their voices heard. Also with Mariana mentioned our state and local chapters, we do a lot of work with those on the ground people to make sure that young people are engaged on the college level, on the high school level, sometimes even middle school level. So making sure that we build those relationships with our chapters and people on the ground is really important. And then also working just federally with the administration and Democrats to make sure that they can amplify as many resources to Gen Zers as possible, making sure that they invest in Gen Z, making sure that our voice actually matters. And so I think all across kind of the level, whether it's federal, state, local, you're going to see a lot of that engagement happen between both political parties and also on the ground chapters and organizations.
Well, I just appreciate both of you so much. I appreciate the work that you're putting in, because for me, it's all about the work. I know a lot of people who run their miles. Lord knows I do. But I've always been fascinated and drawn to people who work, because that is the full measure of your level of commitment and your level of engagement, is how hard you work for the things you believe in and the things you like to see get done. And both of you at Voters of Tomorrow are exemplary models for my generation, all generations to look at and go, yeah, they got this. I'm ready to hand it off to you. It's yours. You can have it. Clean it up, make it better. But you know, I really do appreciate both of you coming on and taking time to sort of talk about the work that you're doing, the impact it's having, young voters in particular are having on our political process, which is extremely important in my view. And it is and has been shown to be a difference maker in cycles starting in 2018. And your track record is good. It's good and it's growing. You've got one of your own in Congress, which is how you really begin to open up that door and get a better and greater access to the table. And now I would encourage you and hearken you to look at state legislative races, county executive races, local races, really building that farm team of Gen Z leadership as an example of the kind of governing majority you hope to be one day. So good luck with that.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's a real treat for me. And again, Victor, to get to hang out with you, and Mariana, to get to see you for the first time and appreciate you and your work as the Deputy Communication Director for Digital Engagement at Voters of Tomorrow. And Victor, of course, who is the co-host of iGen Politics and the director of strategy director for Voters of Tomorrow. Thank you both for spending a little time with us here in the neighborhood of Michael Steele Podcast. You can tell it's old. It's a brain thing. It just goes fart, you know, you just deal with it. Anyway, thank you guys both for being a part of the conversation.
Of course. Thanks so much.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.